Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast. A podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. I have the double pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Purushottama Vilimoria and Dr. Philip Hughes, who are both co-editors of this exciting publication, 2019 Manticore Press publication, The Indian Diaspora, Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. Yes, you heard that, Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. Obviously an understudied area, so this is a really exciting contribution to scholarship. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Namaste.
Yeah, we've decided that namaste is the proper address or salutation for Zoom, because we can't say good night, good morning, good evening. The sun is rising where they are and it's setting where I am. It's interesting. So maybe you can both tell us a little bit about the genesis of the project. And in so doing, tell us a little bit about your affiliations and your disciplinary backgrounds. Whichever wants to go first.
All right, I'll go first. In terms of affiliation and so forth, since I'm sitting in Melbourne, Australia, well, outside Melbourne, in a very beautiful countryside called Venus Bay, my affiliation here is with the University of Melbourne, where I am a principal fellow in the Philosophical and Historical Studies Department, and also with the Australia India Institute, which is a very supportive research institute that I'm engaged with. And then across the Pacific, I'm in California, the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate Theological Union, and the California State University in Long Beach. And then I'm also have affiliations in India with Ashoka University. I was a Fulbright Fellow last year in India and a member of the India International Center. So in terms of the genesis of this project, some years ago in 1989, I had published a book on Hinduism in Australia, Mandala for the Gods. It was really to document for the first time a history and a sort of spiritual experiences of Hindus in Australia, both the immigration and social experiences of Hindus in Australia, because temples had been coming up, especially a very big temple in Sydney, in New South Wales. And I had some funding from a university at that time, Deakin University, to research this topic as part of the growth of multiculturalism in Australia. As we'll speak a little later, since the 1970s, Australia, like Canada, I would say, opened its doors to migrants from the subcontinent and other parts of Asia and Europe, of course, and the Americas. But there was a particular focus that I wanted to place was on Indians. And within that, the two religious communities. At that time, I only worked on Hindus in Australia, although I was interested in the Sikhs as well, and early Muslim migrants. So they became part of the account of Indians in Australia from the early phases of their migration. And then in about about mid-1990s, the Bureau of Immigration and Multicultural and Population Research in the Department of Multicultural Affairs, I think Philip will correct me if that's not the right designation. Commissioned a set of profiles called Religious Community Profiles, of which Dr. Philip Hughes was the chief editor. And since I had worked on Hindus in Australia, he asked me to do the booklet on Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. Philip's own contribution was in the section on Sikhs in Australia, with some of the people coming in on that as well. So that was published in 1996 by the Government of Australia. And then we kept working. One of our third co-editors, who we need to mention here, Jain Balchandra Bapat, who could not be with us today, had been working with me, but on his own as well, because he's a community leader, Hindu community leader, and a priest, as well as an academic. Very rarely you'd get an academic with two PhDs who's also a Hindu priest in the community. So he had a lot of exposure to and experience with the Hindu communities. So we kept writing on Hindus in Australia. I kept writing on Indians in Southeast Australia. We wrote for the big encyclopedia of Australian people. And so we were gathering bits and pieces of further information than on just what I had put together in the 1989 publication, which was pretty small, and the 1996 publication of Hindus and Sikhs. But things had changed by mid 2000s. So about 1996 is a long time away. So in about 2006, we started to think about a more comprehensive project. But then I would be overseas a lot, so we weren't always able to be together. But by 2017, we produced the first edition of the book that we're now talking about, which is a pretty large volume, Indian Diaspora in Australia, Hindus and Sikhs. That came out from DK Print World in India in 2017. I think I'm right. Yes, came out 2015. And then the census happened in 2016. So we decided to update and bring out a revised edition, which you have a copy of now, that came out in 2019 from a publisher, Mentico Press, here in Melbourne. So that's really the genesis of the project. And I'm now pass on to Dr. Hughes to tell us about his involvement.
Yes, so I was working back in 1996 for the Christian Research Association, which had been set up by a number of churches, in fact, to do sociological research on religious faith in Australia. And so part of that understanding of what was happening in religious faith was looking at the growing multi-faith sector in Australia. And then we received this tender from the Bureau of Immigration, Multicultural and Population Research to produce a series of 10 books. They determined which groups we would look at, and I edited the series. I wrote about 5 of them myself on the different groups, and certainly the book on Hindus and Sikhs was a significant part of that. And that was the start of my collaboration with Purushottama. One of the things that happened out of that, however, was that we found that while these series have been designed primarily for government departments, so that they would have a non-proselytizing, systematic, but relatively simple document which would describe how these different religious communities worked, give them some background. What we found was the schools actually used those materials most, and they found them really useful. And as a consequence of that, we took all of those volumes and we put it on one CD. And we added a lot of multicultural and multimedia content to that. So I went and took film of Jam Papath with his own ceremonies within his house, his Hindu ceremonies. I went to the Sikh Gurdwara and took film of what was happening in the Gurdwara and added that to the CD. And so we revised the whole thing. The first edition came out in 2001. We revised it again in 2006 and then again in 2010. So there was a number of editions of this, which the schools have in throughout Australia have used quite extensively. But then, of course, we then decided that we would do this expansion of that work to make a really very full account of Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. And I think certainly from my point of view, it was part of the explaining and telling the story of the growth of the multi-faith movement within Australia, the acceptance of people of different religions within the content of Australia, and how religious faith has actually been transformed by that multicultural environment.
So perhaps this is a good time to talk about the overall structure of the book, maybe just sort of the lay of the land, the table of contents, and then maybe we can dive into some of the chapters afterwards.
Sure. I mean, the book has basically sections on the Hindus and then on the Sikhs and then sort of looking at the whole relationship between the Hindu and Sikh communities and the Australian context a bit and the sort of what that all means. And there's some important appendices too that we might go into in a few moments. But so it actually describes the history, the ways in which those communities are organized at the moment. There's materials about the temples. I've contributed materials on the statistical sort of data from the censuses and so on. We've got very accurate and very full data from our censuses in Australia that more than I think anywhere else in the world, more detail is available from the census on each of the religious communities. And so I've been involved in analysing that and seeing those patterns. I think we need to sort of just note that the Indian diaspora has been the fastest growing group in Australia since about 2005. I think that would be right, wouldn't it, Purushottama?
So
it's become a very significant part of the whole sort of multicultural scene in Australia. So if we actually add the numbers of Sikhs and Hindus together, it's roughly equivalent to the number of Buddhists and roughly equivalent to the number of Muslims in Australia. And in fact, is quite larger than any one of the church-going populations, the largest of which is the Catholics. And there is, you know, about 600,000 people.
Oh, I would have thought Catholics would be in the millions or the Protestants.
Well, the Catholic, those who identify as Catholic are in the millions. But those who, and certainly they're about 5 million. But in fact, when you actually look at those who actually attend, and are involved, you're down to 600,000, which is about the same number of Hindus and Sikhs.
Right. And also, I think we might add that in terms of the language, it is noted that Punjabi is the fastest growing language, which is, of course, is spoken by Sikhs, but also by Hindus from the northern and northwestern regions. So that's a very interesting bit of statistics as well.
And another statistic that might be significant for in America is the fact that the Sikh community is now larger than the Jewish community in Australia, So it's really, while the Jewish community has been here for a very long time and the Sikh community is quite new, certainly the Sikh community is in itself is having a significant place.
So tell us a bit about the history, the story of why there are so many Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. How did that come about?
Well, okay, I could come in on this. It's actually quite an interesting history when you dive into it. Of course, it goes back to the the sort of machinations of the British Empire when the British expanded their empire. Beyond India, let us say, and the East India Company, very well established in India, was establishing itself in India in 1792. They needed labor, and they needed, of course, raw material from places as well, but to produce those raw material, you needed labor. And a number of Britishers came and settled in Australia. So they had experience already of, the sort of the versatility of and the dexterity of Indian laborers. And of course, after the abolition of slavery, they of course started the system called indentured labor. And among them were, a number of Indians who were brought over to the colonies. They were taken to South Africa, Natal, Mauritius, Tanzania, Kenya, Ghana, and all kinds of Ghana, Mauritius, I think I mentioned. And they thought, well, they should have some men in Australia as well. Well, that's the sort of genesis of the demand, at least for Indian labor. They didn't arrive just immediately. The first sort of people who landed, I think, from the Indian subcontinent were Lascars, were people who worked on the boats. And they accompanied their masters and became their servants, became their domestic servants, house servants. Some worked in farms as well. And so the idea of bringing laborers from India goes as far back as 1798. There were recorded something like maybe 10 servants had come initially to work on farms outside Sydney in New South Wales. And they had strong links, as I said, with the East India Company. In fact, even the Togore family were involved in some contact, some cultural contact with residents in Australia, not so much with the Indians themselves, but with the British, as people who liked the Indian culture. And in fact, at Monash University, there's a whole array of whole cupboard full of sitars and musical instruments that were sent by Dwarkanath Tagore. It was a very interesting period. And then the pattern of migration of Indians to other parts of the empire followed in Australia as well. By 1838, there were some 2,000 laborers in New South Wales alone, but there was a lot of concern about diluting the settler labor, but as the increasing white settler population in the country, and with some, I think Europeans may have been coming at that time as well. And it was triggered by a little bit of an incident in Mauritius, which we don't need to go into, but there was a sort of a bit of an outcry across the empire that, these laborers are up to no good. They're opportunists, they're filthy, they're dirty, they're basically heathens. And that's the sort of propaganda that went around in the colonies, in other parts of the colonies in Australia. So there was an attempt to halt migration of Indian laborers, both by the local communities, the local societies, the settler communities, but also by the Indian government, because the laborers were being abused. They were not being paid. Their return fares, which was promised, were not being given to them. And so, they were left penniless, starving, and so on. But that did not actually stop the laborers coming. There was a bit of a gold rush happening in 1850, and that led to migration of people from central India, mostly from Chhotanagpur, but also via via Calcutta, people from Banaras and places like that, and from the south, Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh. So there was a sort of an attitude of, you know, patronizing, as there has always been, you know, British towards Indians, but they were also at the same time apprehensive of the, you know, of their racial makeup. So there was an opposition as well as some positive disposition towards Indian labor. So that's sort of part of the politics, if you like, of imperialism anywhere. There was an incident of a Muslim convict came from via Mauritius, even married a fellow woman convict originally from Liverpool. That was in 1846 in what is now Tasmania. But that was very rare. So there wasn't the intermixing that was going on. In fact, if anything, as time went on, the Indian laborers, particularly among Afghan Kamiliers, who I want to talk about next, from 1860s, a whole lot of Kamiliers were brought into Australia. They married into Australian native population, which we'd call Australian Aboriginal and Torres Islander people. And there are still descendants from those periods who are prominent both in politics but also in sports. So that was very rare. So this is the phase of what I'd call the banishment. You know, they were not exactly banished, but like the convicts were, but they were brought from India to work alongside convicts to go into the hinterland and explore, cultivate, develop farms, and help the pioneers actually to settle in very rugged countries. I mean, it was quite a challenging, not all the settlers could handle in the way that the native Aboriginal people could live quite peacefully and harmoniously in nature, and the Indians could work. And that part of the history was forgotten. So we wanted to bring in as much of this as possible. And they started also to farm themselves. They went on lease properties. They leased properties and started farming banana and sugarcane in northern New South Wales. And those communities are still surviving. They're mostly Sikhs at the time. So there were Hindu Muslims, some of them who came from Baluchi, from Pathan regions. Now they present day Pakistan, and from Afghan came the Kamiliers. By 1890s, there were up to 2,000 Kamiliers. When the contract was over, they either returned or became hawkers. And there was a very common sight at that in the late 1890s of Indian hawkers, who they were called turban intruders. You know, sort of. That was sort of one label given of them, but they were also, you know, very, 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 very good merchants. I mean, they took things into townships. Even here, there is a record of a hawker arriving with his cart and spending a night by the river. You know, he couldn't, there was nowhere else for him to stay. And the local people bought things which they would not have, you know, access to at those times. Some of these items were actually imported from India by other by Indian merchants. So this phase sort of ends in about the 1900s, early 1900s, when a spate of immigration policies, immigration restriction acts were passed by the colonies around Australia, and the rise of the idea, the ideology of white superiority. So it's a part of the part of this sort of Anglo-British Protestant Christian mentality that planted the seeds of what came to be from about 1901, when there was a federation of the colonies in Australia of what was called the White Australia Policy. But still there were about 2,000 to 4,000 Indians. They were called Hindus, H-I-N-D-O-O, Hindus. meaning Indian nationals, among whom, of course, were Afghans, because that was all part of the greater India sovereignty that was under British rule at that time. So just to summarize this part, there was a contribution, there was a need for labor, but they were not treated as well as they should have been, because there was no such thing as civil rights, which of course Gandhi was fighting for in South Africa for the Indian laborers there. There was no such movement in Australia, unfortunately. But it did rise the ire of the settler people here that, well, you know, what if the Indian laborers begin a movement here? A bit like the Gadar movement, as you know, in California and British Columbia, which was started by the Sikhs. So there was fear of these sort of movements, and there were little resistances and clashes and conflicts that went on between the local Indian residents and labor unions, or even white laborers anywhere. So there was a rise of xenophobia, which then led to the decline of Indian immigration from about 1900 till the 1950s, 1960s. There was sporadic immigration during the war, right between the wars, and the people who arrived were mostly merchants and students. So we have to this day very prominent merchant family from Pune who were originally from Sindh area, Sindhis or Pamamuls. They came and joined companies that were mining minerals and so on, mostly gold, but then they moved to mining opal, and they're one of the leading opal traders in Melbourne to this day. And also a great support for the Hindu community, because they set up little welfare groups, social help groups, and women's groups as well. So that's the long and short of it. I will stop here, and we'll have Philip talk about the migration from after the abolition of the White Australia policy, the 1970s, because some very interesting statistics that come into play from that point on.
Certainly, after World War II and the Australian government and the Australian people felt that their country was vulnerable. And as it had been shown to be to the Japanese, we were certainly, Darwin was bombed and so on, and there was real concern that Australia could be sort of conquered by the Japanese. And there was a great desire to build the population. And thus the Australian government was very active in the 1950s to invite migrants. Now, most of the early migrants came from Europe, but there was an increasing sense that we should not be distinguishing people by race and or religion, but certainly should be welcoming people who could contribute to the building Australia. And so certainly in the 70s, the White Australia policy, as it had been called, basically faded away, and we began inviting sort of people from quite different, diverse places into Australia. There was people from Lebanon arrived from the late 60s, early 70s. Then after the Vietnam War, there was a lot of Vietnamese arrived in Australia. And then the coup in Fiji brought a first wave of Hindus into Australia. But Australia's been seen, I think, as a very attractive place to live in a range of ways. I mean, we've got a high standard of living, we've got good wages and so on. But the policies of the government have been to invite people who could contribute to needed professions. And so a large proportion of people have come in because they've got particular expertise. Some of that's been academic, but a lot of doctors, medical people have come in, engineers, people with business expertise and so on. So there's a whole range of classes, of groups of people, of occupational classes that have been invited into Australia. Others have also come as students, and then many of those have stayed on. So certainly there's been a large overseas student population in Australia studying at our universities, and many of them have then found jobs within Australia and have been able to stay. So it's a very different story to the story of the 19th century. I mean, most of the people who've come have been highly educated, and in fact, the Hindu community is the highest educated of all religious groups in Australia, with over half of them having university degrees and a large proportion of them having postgraduate degrees. But that's the people that the Australian government has allowed in with their visa system. And that's created a very particular and peculiar, Indian diaspora in Australia.
And while you have the floor, Philip, do you want to say a little bit in particular about the Sikh community, or is it covered in your narrative at large?
Certainly, the Sikh community has come in often as students. A few have gone into farming and so on. They've also sort of tended to move into a range of occupations. On the other hand, it is also true that a lot of people don't find immediately the positions that are quite equivalent to their occupational status and their educational ability. And in fact, a large number of Sikhs in Australia are drivers. They play a major role in Australia Post in terms of delivering our mail and our parcels. They're also our taxi drivers, large numbers of taxi drivers at the moment. But I see that, I mean, a lot of them have come even within the last 10 years. And over a period of time, we'll see a lot of those people move into other professions as they find ways into the wider community.
Great. What I think would be a great thing to talk about next is the practices. I'll leave it sort of general. Maybe Purushottama, you can start off with Hindu practices in terms of, do you want to talk about temple architecture or things that might be sort of distinctive in this context or similar across the Hindu diaspora? Without leading the question, can you tell us a little bit about the practice of Hinduism in Australia?
Sure. Our co-editor, Dr. Jane Bapat, would have been most appropriate for this part of the discussion. But I followed his work and also done work on the Hindu temples. That's the chapter that I contributed to the book. Very early on, I tried to look for what kinds of practices Hindus were engaged in early on, and is almost kind of minimal. Most worship happened inside the house in a small shrine and so forth. So there is an incident which is connected with the emergence of the, if you like, the temple culture in Australia. A Sri Lankan Hindu couple had been visiting Sydney. They just came as tourists, staying in a hotel possibly. And they were out shopping in one of the big malls, shopping areas, like what is called Myers here, a bit like JCPenney in Australia, in the US. But sadly, the man had a heart attack and he collapsed, died on the way to the hospital. And of course, in India, people would do the funeral within 24 hours. Now, how is this woman going to organize a cremation? I mean, there was nobody, there was absolutely no way. I mean, half the people that, you know, came out to help in Silverth had not heard of cremation in Australia in the early 1970s. So they quickly put her in touch with some a Hindu school teacher who thankfully also served as a part-time priest. And they said, yes, well, you know, we can organize cremation and so forth. But I have to go to a temple to do the worship and make offerings and so forth. Said, no, we don't have any temple. And that sort of triggered a whole, you know, a whole conscience in the community that we don't have a temple, or we should do something about this. Well, that's how a group started in New South Wales, called the Hindu Society of New South Wales. And they went about establishing a temple, got in touch with the Tirupati Devasthanam. It's a very, very big, one of the biggest temples, at least one of the largest pilgrimage places in India, not the biggest temple perhaps, and got some help from them. The architects came out, and a very magnificent temple came up within 5 years. It's absolutely quite a magnificent. That was on the cover of, the temple was on the cover of the first book that I did on Hindus in Australia. Built in the South Indian Chola Pandya style of temple, but also as a cultural center too. So it became a place where Hindus would gather to do their prayers, pujas, worship, but also conduct marriages, initiation of the newborn, the final rites, where they would go in and perform not some of the final rites there, but also do make the offerings and so forth, and then lead the procession on from outside to the funeral parlors, wherever they needed to take the body, the corpse to. That inspired that particular phenomenon of building a temple, which is also, as I said, a cultural center for the Hindus, but also a symbol and a landmark of their arrival and their presence in the country, inspired Hindu communities in other parts of Australia. First in Melbourne, so I was part of the group that designed the temple, actually, laid the first kind of ideas of what sort of a cultural center you'd also want. And one of the emphases we made was that it should also be an educational institute where languages could be taught, where rituals could be taught, and the significance of the rituals and whatever it is that Hindus do in temples or at their homes could be taught to the next generation, to the younger generation. And that's been quite a successful project, actually, in both the temple outside Melbourne called Karam Downs, and also the temples in New South Wales. And then they've come up in other places. I mean, I think Philip has the count of the number of temples that have come up in Australia, and they keep coming up. I mean, each time I'm away overseas and I come back, there's another temple somewhere, to the Devi, to Murugan, to, you know, the South Indian temple, North Indian temple, the Fiji Hindu community that we mentioned earlier that arrived after the two coups in Fiji. They have their own establishment as well, their own temples. The Sri Lankan Hindus are very, very active in all the major temples in the country. They have some of it. They have their own little temples because of the distinctive gods that they would worship or have allegiance to. And now coming back to sort of practices and so forth. Well, there's a range of practices that Hindus do, of course, in any, you know, in any country, especially in India, but they had been brought over here as well. So they observed the samskaras, the birthright festivals, rather the ceremonies, followed by the, you know, the taking of the hair of the infant, of the baby, rather, onto initiation rites for the upper caste boys, especially Brahmins, and then onto ceremonies around puberty. And onwards to marriage, the ceremonies around marriage. So there now, there wasn't even a Hindu celebrant I pushed for that. And Jain Bapat was one of the first, was really the first Hindu celebrant, at least in the state of Victoria. There may have been Hindu celebrants in other states as well. So it was a very rare phenomenon to actually have a Hindu priest and a celebrant who could be, who could be recognized as an official person who could conduct rites and rituals, including marriage and the antyashti, the last rites for the deceased. So it's been a very significant development. But I think Hindus have always continued to have a little shrine in their home, and like right now during the Diwali period, everybody lights a diya or lights a lamp in their homes and worships, give devotion to Lakshmi and Ganesh and Rama and Krishna and Kali and whoever else associated with Diwali. So those things are going on, have been going on in the Hindu families and in the community at large. But increasingly, the temples are becoming sort of more and more significant and important, both as a architectural landmark for their presence in the country, but also a place where they meet other Hindus, take their children to introduce them to the colors and the icons of Hindu spirituality. And also attempt to disseminate the languages that are spoken in their homes. Although, that's a decreasing phenomenon because of the makeup of the society, sort of the requirement of English. But there are places where Hindi and Gurumukhi Punjabi are being taught even in schools. I'm not quite sure it's become an option at the moment for what I call the higher school certificate. But there has been an attempt to introduce Hindi languages, certainly in the university level. Okay, so that I think sort of explains to some extent the prevalence of Hindu practices among the community. Now, as for the Sikh community, the Gurudwaras are very important, and there's been large number of large number of Gurudwaras have come up. In fact, only about 70 miles, about 90 kilometers from here, there is a Gurudwara now, which was never the case 4 years ago. The Sikhs, of course, have their worship a lot more in Gurudwaras. But the early times, they had little tin shacks, sort of tin structures where they would have a Guru Granth, and they would do their kirtans and offer worship. But the first Gurudwara, the large Gurudwara that came up, was in northern New South Wales among the banana plantation community, a place called Woolgulga. It's quite an architectural feat, actually. It's a very, very prominent, wonderful, wonderful Gurudwara Sikh temple. The Sikhs, of course, also celebrate the Guru Nanak. They celebrate Diwali in their own way, and various other points in their own almanac, in their calendar. Of the victory of Guru Gobind Singh and so on and so forth. So that's the Sikh community is very conscious of their spirituality, and they make every effort to develop a sense of belonging among the Sikh community, the first, second, third generation as well. They keep the tradition of wearing turbans and the cloth for the with the hair tied up for the offspring as well. And what else I could mention in this context? The Sikh communities that have come from other parts, from Fiji, from Malaysia, they tend to have their own community establishments. They own gurudwaras sometimes as well. There's an interesting dynamic that goes on in that context as well. And I think you may see that possibly in Canada as well. I think especially in British Columbia, where there are lots of different Sikh communities that have come from different parts of the diaspora, they tend to keep to themselves. There's a very interesting just sort of footnote to what Philip was mentioning earlier. Among the Sikh Punjabi groups who are here, who came over as qualified people, but then couldn't have their qualifications recognized, so they would go to other professions, and they've been very helpful towards the building of gurudwaras as well, because they have some of the skills that are needed to build structures that are closer to the structures of the gurudwara, the Amritsar gurudwara, Guru Sahib, than you know would be available among the architects and builders in Australia. Yes, so I think I should leave that part there.
Sure, Philip. Is there anything you wanted to say about the statistical profiles of these communities? Your contribution to the book.
Just moving on from where Purushottama left us, one of the factors that's been significant in Australia is that the communities are widely dispersed, particularly the Hindu community, and partly because of their occupations and so on, they're not located in particular suburbs to any great extent. They're widely dispersed through the community. What that has meant, however, in terms of temples, at least to some extent, is that there's been no sort of gatherings of populations around a particular temple, as it were. And to some extent, I think different Hindu groups from different parts of India and the worship of different gods has actually taken place within the same temple in some instances in Australia. So you've got people coming together who wouldn't naturally have come together perhaps in India itself. And indeed, I believe that there's still a major project building a large Hindu temple within Melbourne, which quite deliberately is there to bring a variety of communities together. That certainly happened. And one of the other sort of dimensions is that there is some multi-faith activities. So certainly our friend Jan Prapat has been involved in a number of multi-faith weddings where he, as a Hindu priest, has actually taken part alongside a Christian minister and had interfaith weddings and so on. There's been some creativity in designing what's possible in terms of worship within this very different context in Australia. And I do think that religions tend to take on different expressions as they evolve in different contexts. And we've seen just a little of that in Australia so far. My expectation is that even more will happen. One other side of it has been the aspect of the missions. Just close to where I live is the Vedanta Mission for Melbourne. And they've been very involved in multi-faith activities. I chair a local council initiated interfaith network, and they've played a significant role in that network. And so the missions also have been quite significant in bringing Hindu communities together, but also in terms of actually playing a role in the wider community. There's been quite a lot of publicity to the fact that Sikh communities were very active in the some areas in the bushfire, yes, in last January, and helped to bring food and so on to communities that were devastated by those bushfires, and so they're playing a role in the wider Australian population.
Great, yeah, it's fascinating.
That was a very poignant observation Philip made, that there's kind of ecumenism within the Hindu and to some extent Sikh community as well, although they're not as divided in the subcontinent. There are different sectarian groups, but they tend to be together. They're divided more along country national lines than there are among the different sects in the Sikh community. So perhaps not divided, but perhaps they're separated. So for some reason or other, Malaysian Sikhs would want to have their own Gurudwara, and the Indian Sikhs would have their own. But in the Hindu temple, you see Tamil Hindus, North Indian Hindus, other South Indian Hindus coming together with their own gods. So, you'd have under the same roof, you'd have Shiva and Vishnu, which is not very common in the Indian context. So Ganesh, Shiva, Vishnu, Devi, Durga, Kartike, Murugan, Subramanya, all under the same canopy, which is very, very interesting. And that sort of predisposes them to some extent to an ecumenism in the wider context as well, which we refer to as the multi-faith, the interreligious dialogue. But the Sikhs have been also very prominent from very early on in multi-faith, interreligious dialogue and interaction in the community, followed by the Hindus as well, of course.
So we're pretty close to time for today, but before we close, was there anything in particular about the book that you wanted to bring to the fore, or bring to our attention?
Well, for me, it's also a the perspective that I bring in is a more cosmopolitan one as well. So I've been interested in the global phenomena of Indian diaspora and diaspora itself. I mean, that's the whole theoretical. The first chapter in the book is really about the whole notion of a concept of diaspora as is being dealt with by many, many different communities. It starts with the Jewish community, but the term is actually from the Greek experience very early on. So I'm interested in the migration, the movement of people, but also ideas, text, other kinds of capital, if you like, and what happens in the process of settlement and adaptation and so forth. So, in a sense, this is sort of a case study for me of what's going on in the interglobal context. So that's one thing, and that's one phenomenon that for me that's important in this context, and also the global context. So the globalization, if you like, of Hinduism on the political side as well. So we're now not just talking about Hindus, but we're talking about the faith system or the ideology, if you like, called Hindu, and how other forms of Hinduism, nationalist Hinduism, has traveled during Gandhi's time or during Shastri's time. And in recent times, with the rise of Hindutva and the rise of Narendra Modi as a prime minister in India, what kind of impact that's had in the diaspora. And that's another subject matter, but we do deal with that a little bit in the book as well. And similarly with the Sikh diaspora community as well, the rise of Khalistan, the idea of Khalistan, which actually started in the diaspora in Los Angeles and, mind you, also in Australia. So with some backing from Australian Sikhs. So these are interesting dynamics that are to be looked at in the global, for me, in the global phenomenon. But Philip might speak to the sort of spike of, if you like, of Hindu and Sikh communities at the present time, how from since 1970s, even in 2000 census, we had something like 300,000 Hindus and 120,000 Sikhs. And now the figures are sort of, you know, like exponential. They've sort of grown almost double. I think I'd be right to say that, Philip.
Yes. From my point of view, I think one of the most interesting aspects of the underlying the book is, in fact, the story of multiculturalism in Australia, and how this particular part of multiculturalism comes into the Australian context, expresses itself in new ways in that context, but also how it's received by the wider community. And certainly I've got some statistics there. I mean, the level of acceptance of Hinduism has risen over the last 10 years as it's been measured. In a recent survey, 2018, we've got 25% of the population who said that they were quite positive to Hindus. 50% are neutral. Often a lot of people don't know a Hindu and don't have a particular feeling. There's about 15% of the population who feel negatively towards the Hindus, and a lot of those people would feel negatively about most of the other religious groups too. There's always a group of people who find it hard to accept people who are different from themselves. But 80% of the population said that they would accept a political candidate of different religions. And we certainly in my own area, one of the candidates who stood and got close to getting in last time was a Sikh woman who were very skilled in law and so on. 70% of the population say that they respect all religions. So there is a wide acceptance. It varies from place to place, and certainly I think in the multicultural cities where people are used to having a variety of people around them from different backgrounds and of different faiths and so on, there's a greater acceptance. There's certainly a greater acceptance amongst the more highly educated, and there's a greater acceptance amongst younger people rather than older people who have not perhaps had the same exposure, certainly through school, that younger people have had to peoples of different backgrounds. But there is this broad acceptance, and I think multiculturalism in Australia in general works. And I think this book is to some extent a testament to that, how a community can maintain its identity, maintain its faith, its origins within this multicultural environment.
Fantastic. That's
I just wanted to add, to the increasing participation of Hindus and Sikhs non-aligned Indians as well, as I would call them, is certainly increasing at local government levels. I think we see that quite a bit, right? I mean, at local government levels, perhaps not as yet in the state or the national levels, in the way we see it in Canada. I mean, with Trudeau's having very close Sikh members as his ministers and so on. I mean, that hasn't come to Australia, but hopefully it will. It has happened in New Zealand, which is very interesting. And we are making some comparisons of Hindus in New Zealand and Australia, which is and Sikhs in Australia and New Zealand as well. But in the US, there have been Sikhs at least, and now increasingly Hindus, have been entering the House of Representatives. And now, of course, Kamala Harris, who comes from a part Hindu family, Tamil family, is possibly the next vice president of the United States. So that's something that we might want to aim for it in Australia as well.
Unless I'm not mistaken, she's definitely the next vice president of the United States.
I'm thinking of Mr. Trump. You see, I don't want to be too insulting to him and his aspirations. Of course, I vote in California, so you can imagine where my votes would have gone.
Well, suffice it to say, the world is changing, throughout the globe, we see the rise of multiculturalism, and we also see the boons and the challenges incurred by such as the natural evolution of becoming a globe. Never before have we had to do this. We're learning to become a globe. Gentlemen, it's been great speaking to you today about this really interesting, fascinating publication. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Will you show the, I don't have a copy of it, but would you put up on this podcast, image of the book? That's great. And also sure. A link to where it's available. It's available in Amazon.com, but it's also available from the publisher. I think that would be appreciated. Show this
in the Yeah, as per the custom for the New Books Network as a whole, including this podcast channel, there'll be a description with both of you and your bios in the description of the book, and there'll be links to how one can get the book. And I certainly will forward the image of the cover to them as well. So if they're not already going to use that, they will now.
Wonderful. And what is the distribution? I mean, who does this podcast reach? Does it go through the diaspora community, or is it more?
There's a conglomeration called the New Books Network, and it is a consortium of approximately 85 subject area podcasts. So there might be a New Books in X Studies and Y Studies. I host the New Books in Hindu Studies, and so I look at all of the new scholarship in the field, and the textures of the channels will fluctuate as per the pensions of the hosts and the discipline and the interest, and they're all their own separate entities. As for this channel, it's bizarrely popular for something so nerdy, and so there are a great number of lifelong learners, you know, people interested in Hinduism, certainly a great number of folks in the diaspora, and a great number of our specialist colleagues as well. So it's a wide range of people either interested in learning more about Hindu studies or looking to hopefully vet the book for purchase or vet the book for their own research or their teaching, if that makes sense.
That's how you picked up the Hinduism and Contemplative Studies that I co-edited with Rita Sharma.
Yes, and that's how you contacted me, because Purushottam was actually the co-editor of that book that we did with Rita Sharma, and he had contacted me to cover this book. So, indeed, that's how.
So, and we've got now Contemplative Studies in Jainism coming out too.
So, we can certainly cover that on this podcast as well, because we're exceedingly. Looking at various developments in South Asian religion. So given that there isn't a channel dedicated to Jain studies, I've indicated to them I'm happy to cover Jain studies on this podcast as well, because it's so inextricable from the fabric of Hinduism in many contexts. Fantastic. Yeah. So you'll stay on for a moment, and I'll formally sign off for those of you listening out there. thank you for listening. Your first priority is staying safe. Your second is continuing to listen, continuing to read, and continuing to contemplate the Indian diaspora. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much.